the last name with either a Mr. or a doctor.
No,
That's
no,
my
no.
old habit.
No.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Anil.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tarun has been telling me about you for quite some time, so finally we are here face to face.
It's his greatness. I've always told him that, I'm a very small person.
No, you're doing fundamental
He
work, unlike us
sees
journalists.
something else.
I'll do the introduction separately once the recording is over. So we will straight away get into the questions if you don't mind.
Okay.
We are meeting in the midst of diverse global catastrophes caused by climate change. At your institute, you've been involved among many other projects in renewable energy research. What is the status of renewable energy in India, and how can villages lead the action?
I'm a little pessimistic because I have seen a lot of water flow through the Ganges. The whole scenario of R&D is very poor in India, and renewable energy is a part of that. And in fact, when I was talking to some of my former friends in MNRE, Ministry of New Energy, so they said that most of it is gone. Now major focus is on setting up solar and wind power plants. That's all.
I
So
see.
research as such. And the sad part is that we all know that the world moves ahead because of research. Whatever we are today is because of the research and the technology developed because of that we are here. But somehow there is no vision of research and development very much in the Indian higher authorities. That's all.
It's always baffled me why it is that India has been so lagging in pure R&D for such a long time. You have a PhD from the University of Florida. You are an innovator. What is your sense of why? Is it a cultural drawback? What do you think is at work here?
No, I see. We do wonderful things when we go abroad. Half of the Silicon Valley is owned by my classmates from IIT Kanpur, and Europe, everywhere there are Indians who are doing fantastic work in R&D and so many other things. It is just the systematic erosion of the ecosystem in research and development that has taken place in this country that it has come to this level.
And you think it is across party lines, or it has
Yes.
deteriorated?
Because you see, the question is that who are the, see, after all, when I was in the United States, one of the top NASA scientists, was my professor. He got the NASA's highest award for Saturn V rocket design. So I used to ask him, I said, what makes America tick? And then he used to say, the politicians are same everywhere, but in America in those times, they had this thing that if they set up a committee and if the committee of experts gave a report, then they followed that. And in fact, that was true in Manhattan Project, because a very well-known Stanley Ulam was my colleague in University of Florida. He's the father of hydrogen bomb. He was part of the Manhattan Project and the NASA and etc. This was all because of the tremendous faith that the politicians had on the ability of the researchers and scientists to come up and then follow it.
But one can turn around and argue that we are in the 75th year of independence, and
Yes.
at the dawn of independence, a prime minister like Jawaharlal Nehru went out of his way to talk about scientific temper. He
Yes.
set up any number of high education institutions. So one can say that we began so well, the pace should have continued. What went wrong in between?
Because he was educated. That's the only thing I can say.
Well, we have had someone like Manmohan Singh, who had a PhD, right?
Yeah, but Manmohan Singh, by the way, is a very, very dear friend of mine.
I see.
We talk. In fact, just last week I called him. He was very
Interesting.
yes. And I've known him for almost 20, 21 years.
Yeah.
And so when we meet, it is a very enjoyable meeting because it's a meeting of the mind.
Right.
But he worked under a lot of restrictions. And so let's not get into that. But it's just that I feel bad. And then what happens is that, you see, in America and in Europe, not only the politicians give the push, but it's the captains of the industry who are aware, who have the tradition of research and development. Somehow that has not happened in India, because all the people who come into the industry, most of the industries are family-owned, so they all MBA, etc. So this is just making money, that's all.
Right.
And they feel they can buy the technology anywhere and they can run with it.
How would you look at this very strange practice of jugaad that India seems to be extolling and celebrating with such gusto? I mean, I understand that people do jugaad at ordinary levels because they don't have ecological or systemic help, unlike here in the US, for instance. But jugaad as a national attribute is troubling, don't you think?
Of course it is. You know, I have written a lot of the things about against it, and I've talked about it, because jugaad is a lazy man's solution. It's very short term, but for the long term, for the country, we need an extensive, very high R&D. And in fact, I have been talking for the last 30 years, and I was the first one to talk about high technology for rural development. And now everybody is talking about it, because I always felt that if I have to design a lantern and make it, it should have the same technological inputs as making a Maruti car.
Right.
In fact, more R&D is required, because the resources are limited, the things are limited, because you don't have too much of leverage in designing. So you have to really think very deeply about it.
Right.
So jugaad is an absolutely nonsensical thing.
But it seems to have struck roots. People really celebrate that.
Yeah, because of the fact that I'm sorry to say that, because I'm a free person, so I can say that most of the scientists are basically political scientists. They get their patronage from the politicians. And politicians understand jugaad very well. So they, for example, what is the reason for having a lot of money on looking at only at cow urine?
Yeah.
And this is very strange, very, very strange. There are so many problems in this country. There are so many wonderful people. And we don't train. In fact, that has been my pet peeve for the last so many years. I give talks in IITs that, I tell the faculty that for 4 years, you can't make the students interested in engineering. What type of teaching are you doing?
Yeah.
They all go to MBA. They say, because of the money. I said, no. I'm a product of the same IIT. And I was so inspired when I went to the United States about the higher things. And I'm not unique. There must be hundreds and thousands of students like that.
Right. From an electric cycle rickshaw to and ethanol, lantern, and stove, you've pioneered many remarkable solutions. How widespread is the culture of innovation? You already said you are pessimistic on that account. But do you think the younger generation is beginning to see any merit in the kind of work that someone like you is doing it?
Not at all.
Oh.
I have a very tough time. The funny part is when I go to IITs and IIMs and I tell the students, they get very inspired.
Yeah.
Because it's an interesting story, a very different story. And then they go back to their parents and their peers. They say, where the hell do you want to go? Are you ruining your life? They don't understand that one or two years, they will learn so much. They can work with their hands. So they just have no understanding. And also the fact that they have never done anything with hands. Our whole education system today is just passing exam,
right,
one after another. And the professors and the teachers, they think that is very easy. And so these guys are simply passing exam right from childhood to the end. And when they are all the time involved in passing exam, where is the time to think innovate, work with hands. There's no culture. It's a very sad thing.
No, it is astonishing. You're right. Even when I was growing up in the late 60s and 70s, even I was exposed to things like carpentry and sewing and a whole lot of other things. But that seems to have completely disappeared.
See, I went to the top institute, IIT Kanpur. Right. That was number one because an American aided. We had a 5 years program. In fact, whatever I am today is because of the education that I got in IIT Kanpur at that time. And we had everything. We made projects out of wood. We made projects out of metal and so different things. And you learn so much. In fact, my professor, because we had to also go through all other engineering. So I took a couple of courses in electrical engineering. And we used to work with transistors in those time, 1968, 69. Transistors were very expensive because everything was imported from America and used to burn. And my professor said, now please write 10 ways in which you can burn the transistor. Now that was a very eye-opening phenomena. When you do your hand, then you realize.
Yeah.
Now the guys don't even know the difference between the spanner and a screwdriver.
Yeah, forget knowing the difference. They don't even know the nomenclature for that.
Exactly.
You know, I was struck when I first started coming to the U.S. Mm. Every little thing, if you go to a Home Depot, every little thing has a name.
Yes.
If you ask a salesperson, you're looking for a quarter inch screw or 4x4, they know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
I think I'm troubled because in a country which has the concept of Vishwakarma, hands-on work used to be celebrated. But I find it's getting looked down upon as the country modernizes and becomes more urbanized.
When I came for the first time to this place where it was so horrible that to make a long-distance call, I had to sometimes hop on the bus, take a four-hour journey to Pune and make a phone call. Our institute was around 6 to 7 kilometers away from the town.
Oh.
And when the institute building was made, the toilet, bathroom were kept outside because my father-in-law, who was the initiator of this institute, said that if we have the toilet in the building, then it will smell like nobody's business. So when I came, I found the toilet to be the most horrible. And I have always believed in Gandhian principle, and I'm a very fetish about toilets and other things. So I said I sent a note to all the scientists that we clean the toilets, and there was a major revolt. They said we are scientists. So out of 40 people who were there, only 4 said we will clean with you. So I put the handkerchief on my nose, and I cleaned the toilet, showed them how it can be done.
Yeah.
And there were only 4 of us, so I locked the toilet, gave the key to the 4 of them. And for 2 years, these guys went out in the field and did it.
Really?
But they were not interested in doing the dance. And this is the land of Gandhiji.
Yeah, but what is that contempt? Where does that come from? Is it... I'm glad you're saying it yourself, but it's so deep-rooted.
Yes, it is. It is. This is not my work.
I'm really speechless when I keep hearing that. But
this has been my philosophy of life, that I do whatever, and that is the reason why I did whatever it is. I just do things which I enjoy.
Right.
And whatever it takes to do things, I do it. Yeah. I don't care about others. My classmate said that I was doing a harakiri by going to a place, rural. In fact, probably I was probably the first Indian IIT and to go to rural India.
Yeah.
Stuck to it.
You know, speaking of that, your organization, NIMCAR, or is it NIMBAK?
It's NIMCAR. NIMCAR.
NIMCAR. NARI, as the short form goes.
Yes.
Your engagement with solar power has existed since 1987.
Yes. Because I did my PhD in solar energy.
Yeah, when it built what is said to be the world's first solar power plant for the distillation of ethanol. How has that been scaled up in the last 3 decades or so?
Okay, when we did that, naturally, it was a very unique thing. And I learned a lot of things by doing that. In fact, it was very interesting. After I built this in 85, and there was a very major international conference in Germany. So I went there to present this work. The Germans could not believe it. They thought that I was making a fun, or because they had done the solar thing in a few test tubes. And this suddenly was a pilot plant. So when I did that, I suddenly found out that the solar energy was not the right way to approach because it was very costly. 80% of the cost came from the solar collectors. And there were other, that was not the thing. So distillation was a small part. What we pioneered was the use of sweet sorghum for ethanol production.
I see.
We introduced sweet sorghum in India in 1970s. And at one time, we had set up at our institute one of the largest program of sweet sorghum, starting from breeding sweet sorghum, fermenting it, distilling it, and then using it in alcohol stoves and lanterns. And we became the first institute in India to be invited for the Europe Economic Commission. There was a group on sweet sorghum. And because of our effort, we feel very proud that now there are a large number of universities and institutes in India which are working on sweet sorghum. And now government of India has brought again the alcohol. And I think it's a very stupid thing of using alcohol for cars, the 2% efficient car. Right. And we are using a very great chemical called ethanol, which can go for chemical industry. But that's a different thing already.
Right.
So that we feel very, very proud of it.
There is a great deal of political talk about solar power in India. In fact,
yes,
there are those who say that it's doing fairly well in terms of creating capacities across the country. What is your sense of that, and how do you think we might compare with China?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm very skeptic about some of the numbers.
I see.
And the numbers that are put, so many gigawatts, we are not sure how much has been actually put on the ground and how much is in pipeline. So whatever is put on the ground, then naturally that is feeding in the grid. So that number that we keep on quoting, the 35% of India's energy is coming from renewable, that should be taken as a pinch of salt. This is my sense. Now, it's a very good thing that but only 2-3 players are getting into this big business of putting solar and wind, which is fine as long as it is in the India. Our biggest problem is we don't make the main ingredients of solar and wind in India. Solar, the silicon is not manufactured in India. It comes from abroad. So as long as we do not manufacture the basic raw material, there is no point in which we can compare with China.
I see.
Even today, the solar water heater, the tubes, all manufactured in China. And there's nothing great about it. It's just that we do not have that manufacturing process in this country.
I see.
To do that. So we are just buying all this using a screwdriver and putting it on large scale, which is fine as long as it is providing the energy.
Right. You know, India is a solar heaven, as it were. Why is it that it's not as widespread as it should be? I mean, you're saying 35% is a number that you take with a pinch of salt.
Yes.
Say for the sake of argument that it's 20% or even half that. Yes. It is still not a bad number to begin to build upon, right?
No. But the question is that we don't have any storage. So because we have so much of power shortage, so whatever is produced is used.
Right.
And in fact, I worked in 1970s in America, in our lab with the pioneer in solar energy. And we looked at the storage in terms of the low temperature water heating. And we felt that though the efficiencies may be low, but running an organic Rankine cycle at 70 to 80 degrees Celsius water, we can run the whole damn thing for 24/7. And that is something which I have really pushed in MRI. But I think like in everything else, we just I don't have the political clout, so just like that.
It's tragic because if you decide to solarize, as it were, 600,000 Indian villages,
yes,
it would be the world's greatest achievement in many ways.
It is. It is. And I keep on telling the people that, listen, the world's biggest solar energy collector are the green plants. Their efficiency is very low. It is less than 1%.
Yeah.
But the numbers are huge. Because whenever I talk about these systems, like my solar thermal system, they say, oh, it is very poor efficiency. I said, these are very simple systems, modular. They can be scaled up very rapidly.
Right. NARI has also helped create more than 1,000 biomass power plants across
India. Not 1,000 biomass, 1,000 megawatts.
Okay. Because I think I misunderstood from your website.
Yeah.
What are the prospects of biomass emerging as a major source of clean energy?
Unfortunately, it has not picked up very much for so many reasons. Now it is picking up because of the pollution. You see, all these residues, theoretically speaking, should go into the soil to improve the soil. Because the soil in India is in a very bad shape. But the farmers don't have the patience to do that, so they just burn because it is a waste disposal problem. So when I set the national policy in 1990s, we were just 20-25 years ahead of time. But that national policy allowed all the biomass mapping of the whole country as a part of the Taluk program. So that we felt was a very great achievement because of our work. And then after that, they set up around 100 to 150 power plants of 10 megawatt. So it was around 1500 megawatt. Now it is coming up because people are coming back to COP26, reducing carbon footprint. So a lot of these companies who have coal-based fired boilers, they have started using biomass. And the other day I was talking to the, because they wanted my advice, the Tata Power. And I said that we should use the co-firing of the coal boilers with the biomass.
I see.
So it will take time for it to pick up.
Okay.
But I think it is ultimately the competing financial gain that a farmer sees, either giving it to the power plant or putting it in the soil as a soil conditioner.
Right. After your bachelor's and master's degrees from the IIT Kanpur in 1972, you got your PhD from the University of Florida in 1979, where you taught as well.
Yes.
How has that sound academic background influenced the way you have worked on, say, things like renewable energy in rural India?
Well, everything. I learned to do all this thing in the United States. IIT Kanpur education was a very different education because it opened up my mind. But a lot of things I learned from my professor, who was a very, very remarkable man with his hands-on approach. And then there was this Janoon. I did not know a damn thing about anything that I worked on. I did not know anything. I said, I am an engineer and it's a training of the mind. You see, what is missing is people to understand. They get mechanical, chemical engineering. They say that they are mechanical engineers, chemical engineers. It's total nonsense. They don't know anything. They have just passed exam. Engineering is a training of the mind. And this is what I learned in America, that when you can take anything, spend time, and you should be able to solve it. And that is the reason why I spent so much time also on spirituality, brain research.
Yeah.
I do read very dense brain research papers. So to understand what is happening and then try to correlate the modern brain research with the ancient Patanjali, etc.
And
the same training that I did in engineering, I apply the same methodology of the science and technology for this.
You know, speaking of that kind of training, I'm digressing a bit, but I would like to illustrate what I'm about to say. There's a very well-known professor here called Dr. Bharat Thakkar. He's a very highly regarded reliability expert.
Mm-hmm.
When our India's moon mission failed,
yes,
literally within 2 to 3 hours, he sent me an email saying that there is no way that Kraft could have survived. These are my calculations. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely precise on the spot. So I did a story for the wire service, IANS. Mm. And there was a great deal of reaction in India because they thought this was a challenge to our national pride and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the simple fact is it was a very clear engineering reliability calculation that Dr. Thakkar came up with. And finally, ISRO acknowledged that it was destroyed completely. Why is it that we are not able to take this into our planning and change the way we think?
You see, what happens is that if you allow the scientists, technologists, freedom of thinking and actually doing, then the things are so fascinating that they will come up with the right number. They may fail, but they will come to the right number. When the pressures, political pressures are there, because it's a matter of national, whatever it is, then they can do a lot of mistakes and a lot of stupid things. For example, I used to give, I have a lot of friends, very senior people from Atomic Energy Commission, etc. I tell them that, in America, they caught some high school guy. He had everything that he could make the atom bomb. You don't require 5,000 crores per year budget for a simple atom bomb.
Scalability is one of the biggest challenges for any solution of the kind that NGOs such as NARI works on. How do you resolve that challenge, or do you think the importance of scalability is often overstated in the sense we should be perhaps looking for distributive solutions rather than one big national solution?
No, distribution or distributive or scalability, it has nothing to do with, the main thing is that idea should go into mass production or whatever it is, so that it can be useful for as many people. Now, just take the case of our electric rickshaw. Now, we are a very small NGO, but we developed a lot of very innovative ideas. Right. They were copied, and today, a lot of the electric rickshaws which are running in India, they came from our design, whatever it is. We never got a single penny, but we got this tremendous satisfaction that the idea spread. And so the same thing has happened in so many things. Now, another thing that is happening, and which is what I am now pushing, and that was my Tata talk that I gave, this is startup ecosystem that is coming up. I have a feeling that the innovations that we produce in our NGO, because we are a unique NGO that is a science and technology NGO.
Right.
Most of the NGOs, are for social and etc. And I keep on telling the government and other people that, you should have a separate section for such NGOs. And when we have something like that, then I am trying to push this idea that the ideas, we can get people from the corporate, they can work for a year or 2 years in our NGO, look at these ideas, and then have a startup in which the companies can provide the venture capital. So it will be a good thing for them to have a business. At the same time, our ideas will, because you see, what you make as a prototype and what comes out, there's a lot of difference between the lip and the gum. And that is something which has to be looked at very carefully.
Right. To broaden the conversation a bit, is it your sense that the stellar record over the millennia that India has clearly shown, it's just a historical fact, has been so cynically co-opted into this nationalistic mindset these days that we are more focused on boasting about what happened 1500 years ago or 2000 years ago than rather than building upon that tremendous achievement, be it metallurgy, be it nanoscience, as you see in the Ajanta Ellora caves, the pigmentation that was created. Why is it that we are not building on that rather than just talking about a one-upmanship?
Because it's a lazy man process. And the other thing is very funny, because I write a lot on this. All our scriptures and etc. that we talk about, they came to us in written form 500, 600 years ago.
Right.
Now, Patanjali, we still do not know, because I have written a lot of articles on Patanjali. and I have read almost everything on Patanjali. And I just cannot believe that something which was written 3,000 years ago came intact till today. When I read Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, I know that there are a lot of input by a lot of people who did not understand. Because there are certain gems in Patanjali Yoga which are really fantastic, just like Einstein. But there are a lot of very stupid things also in there.
Sure.
So this is what is the problem. You have to read between the lines, take the things which are useful, and not, you see, I have always said that, and I have been a person out of line. When we are very insecure, we try to glorify our past. After Absolutely. All, we should think about that we are brilliant. You know, I am a very proud Indian, and I think our genetic code is very fantastic. The country which gave the greatest thought to the world, Buddha, Sikhism, Gandhi, there's so many things.
Right.
We're not bad people. And we are running the world now in the different countries. So it's just that we need to create a great ecosystem in our society to make this country a great country.
But everything gets entwined these days with the great resurgence of the Hindu pride.
What's up?
Yeah, but I often talk to my journalist friends here. I think it's irreversible now, what has happened.
No, I don't think so. You see, I'll tell you, my father went to jail with Gandhiji. Now, my father used to tell me that when Tommy means a white soldier,
right,
when he came on the footpath, all the natives would come down. He said, can you believe that 300,000 white Englishmen, they ruled a 30 crore country?
Absolutely.
It was a crisis of confidence, which Gandhi changed. So all these are the crisis of confidence. And I am a great believer, after all, at one time the greatest gunda was Sanjay Gandhi, but gravity took care of it. So there are forces which people don't think.
But nature has to intervene, I suppose. Nature has to intervene at some point.
Exactly. So yeah. I always believe that, you know, this is a great country. We have great people.
And absolutely. Conversely, do you think this resurgence of what I call Hindu pride can be built upon in such a way that we get back to the business of doing what India was doing so well for millennia? Yes.
And that is what I write. That is exactly what I write. In fact, my latest book, Exploring the Mind of God, how technology guided by spirituality can produce happiness. And that is my theme, because I believe that the essence of India has been the great philosophical thought, not this stupid religion, great philosophical thought, because when you become spiritual, you are looking for the truth.
Right.
Truth is beyond barriers of caste, creed, country, anything.
Absolutely.
And when you do that, then you are honest to yourself and honest to everything else.
Yeah. You know, as the world struggles to ensure that the target of keeping average global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius to avert a complete climate disaster, international eyes are trained on India and China. What is it that you think India can do? You are at the front line of these things. What do you think India can do to ensure that it remains below 1.5? It's not going to happen, but is there any way out of it?
Well, you see, I have a little different outlook in this. I look at a thermodynamic point of view. Mm-hmm. Earth, Sun is a thermodynamic system. Yes, we are measuring precisely the temperature of air. We are measuring precisely the temperature of the water in the ocean, and they are increasing. We still do not know the real reason for that. We call it as earth warming by humans because it provides a huge amount of funding for a lot of scientists.
I see.
There could be a lot of natural systems, because after all, the energy that we get from the on this planet Earth is from the sun. Then there is also the energy which is coming from the hot Earth also. The Earth's magnetic field is changing from north to south.
Right.
the you know, because I did a lot of work in the cloud physics when I was doing my PhD.
Oh, I see. Okay. So
I know a lot of a little bit about clouds, and I was also in contact with the pioneer of the cloud seeding at General Electric, Irving Langmuir. He was died. Right. He died, but his right hand man who developed this was Schaefer, and I used to interact with him. Now, clouds are charged particles.
Right.
And when the Earth's magnetic field is changing, the total amount of cloud cover in this world is same. Where it is following as a rain is different.
I see.
And this is never factored in the IPCC and other reports.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I don't have the, neither the you know, if I was young, I would have done all the calculation, but not anymore. And I feel that is something which should be factored in. That's one part. Secondly, I really feel that if you just take the mass of humans, the mass of Earth, the whole structure, we are very, very small.
Right.
And I just don't understand how can we affect in such a profound manner. So there are other forces, geological basically, and the sun is giving the same amount of energy. But when the magnetic field changes, then the interaction creates a lot of very interesting things.
But the fact that it has coincided with the rapid industrialization of the world and the kind of emissions that have taken place, I think it's perhaps intuitive for people to think that very significantly we have caused it. And so far, the jury says that indeed it's us. I mean, Earth has its own logic, but we are the ones who speeded it up.
I remember when I was a student, Walter Cronkite was a very big.
Yeah, sure.
In one of the, I think, end of his news thing, he said that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is directly proportional to the number of rats in the New York sewage. So you can correlate anything you want. Statistics are a fantastic thing, number one. Number two, I feel that irrespective, if it helps us in becoming, leading a sustainable life, then that is a very good thing.
Right.
Because all our pandemics, all our lot of things, and I've written a lot on that in the South Asia Monitor, etc.,
right,
that these are because of the unsustainable lifestyle that we have.
Yeah.
And if it can change, then all the force and the power to be.
Right. You know, I mentioned Bill McGuire, who is a very well-known British scientist. He says that it's no longer a question of whether it will happen. He says it has already happened. The climate breakdown is with us. All that we can do now is to live around it. What is your sense of that?
No, I think that it is going to happen because, you know, I have shown with my own life. I live in the house, you know, you might like to read how I live for the last 35 years. And I have done a very detailed calculation on the terms of energy and et cetera. And in 1/4 the average energy spent by an American, I live a very sustainable and very emotionally satisfying life.
Right.
And very modern life. So one can live like that. And when you see at Gandhiji, this is what he said, that each one of us, when we start becoming sustainable, the world will become sustainable.
Absolutely.
We don't have to talk about big in meetings and this and that, etc. We should just start with us.
Right. You know, this is an interesting segue for me. We are just coming towards the end of the conversation. Gandhi is clearly someone who has been intrinsic to your worldview.
Yes.
Given India's current political climate and dispensation, how hard is it for you to continue to point out the importance of following his ideas?
Well, more than ever, because I write a lot of articles on him. And in fact, a lot of times, you see, this is his biggest tragedy. Just 2 days back, Supreme Court allowed the showing of this movie, Why I Killed Gandhi.
Right.
And there was so much of lies in that movie. And I give lectures now to my school children that this here was the greatest man. And we should read about him. We should read what he wrote. And all this nonsense that comes out in the WhatsApp and the social media, we should really go back to the real books of the independence movement and talk about. Besides that, his great ideas on sustainability, his great ideas on all-inclusive development, communities to work together. This is something that we need more than ever.
Right.
That what when he wrote. And so it is, his sayings and his teachings are more relevant today. His non-violence, you know, these are things which we should be looking at. And we don't read it. We just think that he was a very useless person because he talked all the time about non-violence. Not realizing that non-violence does not come from a weak person. It comes from a very tremendous strength.
True. You know, interesting you should mention some of those ideas. I have been following that for a very long time now. In fact, I produced a documentary called Gandhi's Song on Vaishnava Janata. I'll send you the link. How it is at the core of Gandhi's life. But people forget that it was written 600 years ago by Narasimha Mehta.
Exactly.
My point was about, at a time when we are celebrating the rise in individual wealth, there are billionaires everywhere now in India. Here was a man, Gandhi, who talked about trusteeship.
Yes.
That wealth is trust. I mean, it's not individual, it is shared, communal.
Yes.
Now, an idea like that was radical even then.
Yes.
Do you think an idea like that can be even talked about now?
Yes. I gave a very big lecture in June to Tata Group with the chairman of Tata and 40 CEOs of the top Tata companies. So around 180 people were there, and I was a chief guest. And this is what I talked about. I said, you've practiced CSR. When Gandhiji developed his trusteeship, he had the example of Jamshedji Tata.
True.
People don't understand, know that. So it's a remarkable thing. And Tatas in the early times really believed in that. That whatever money they make, they should really give it in CSR, etc. Today, CSR is very well known.
Yeah.
But it was practiced by Tatas almost 120 years ago.
Yeah, CSR is legally mandated, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And people are getting around it because now more and more money is going back to the parties and political parties and et cetera, et cetera. But the real thing is that they should really help the country because that is where the wealth comes from.
Right.
And Gandhiji, what he did and said was correct. And, you know, you should also realize that those Birlas and Bajaj were as crooked as they are today. But it was Gandhiji's great ideas and noble intentions that they got into the freedom struggle. Some people told me that they got into the freedom struggle because they knew that they will have a huge market because of Gandhiji.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible, but that is not what Gandhi was driven by, right?
Exactly.
You can't inflict their sins on him. He would use whatever he had at his disposal to achieve the goal of independence.
And Mayank, I have written a lot of articles on Gandhiji.
I would love to read them. I'll check it out. Yes. I think there are some links on your website.
Yes, and also where my writings are, there's a whole section on Gandhiji.
Oh, wonderful. I'm a passionate Gandhi reader, and these days it's completely out of fashion to talk about Gandhi.
In fact, a lot of people write to me that, you know, it's amazing that you at this age and time, you write about Gandhiji. Because I've read extensively and you have to read, you know, everybody is a prisoner of his or her time. You have to read between the lines.
Absolutely. You know, I often tell my friends that in 1916, when he came to the Banaras Hindu University, when he started his speech, he talks about how filthy it was to go to Kashi Vishwanath temple.
Yeah.
And people are looking at him, why is this man talking about filth?
Yeah.
His point was that we don't want, if we can't handle that, how are we going to handle larger issues?
And I talked about Gandhi as an engineer. In fact, that came as a byline in Nature. Because in 1929, he put out a 1 lakh rupee award for developing a fantastic new charkha. 1 lakh rupee in 1929 is equivalent to around bigger than the Nobel Prize. And a man who people say that he was anti-technology and anti-science, how could he put such a big award for developing the technology?
Right. Right.
And in fact, he set up two committees, and never in the history of India we had a committee where two Nobel laureates were in the committees,
yeah.
Rabindranath Tagore and C.V. Raman.
Right.
And the committee's main thing was to what goes into jaggery and how we can make better jaggery and what are the ingredients of jaggery.
So that's really interesting.
Exactly.
As I let you go, I want you to tell me what your larger vision for India is at this time, especially when a lot of people despair at the direction in which not just India, but a lot of the other countries are going. What is your personal vision that you think can be translated into reality?
My personal vision is that I'm very optimistic. I think that the future of India is naturally its youth, because they are the biggest. And we as elder people who are older generation, we need to guide them in the right path of the old Indian philosophy tradition. When the guru pointed by finger the path, the person has to follow it, but it should be done honestly. And if we follow our old path, so spirituality plus high technology is what should be the mantra for India's development. And I think we should teach our youngsters on to following this. And if we do that, not only we will help the 1/5 of mankind, but we'll change the world. And I really believe that we have the capability of doing that.
On that sanguine note, Anil, I really want to thank you for your time. It was fascinating. Maybe some other time we'll connect again, because the way you were talking about Gandhi and other subjects, physics, by the way, my background is physics. I recently was talking to, I don't know if you know Dr. Abhay Ashtekar, who is a pioneer in loop quantum gravity and a prospective Nobel laureate. He won the Einstein Prize 2-3 years ago. Brilliant, brilliant man. So when I talk to someone of a science background like you are, I'm a particularly happy man. So I'm so glad that we talked.
Because, you know, a lot of people, in fact, I get a lot of emails that, are you the same guy who also works in technology, because most of my spiritual writings are much more.
Right.
So that reminds me, you know, Cooper, who got the Nobel Prize for superconductor. So we invited him to University of Florida. I used to be the seminar coordinator. So after the talk, we had a coffee. So I asked him, you know, he gave a talk on the consciousness. So I said, Professor Cooper, you got the Nobel Prize in superconductivity. So yeah, that was my baby, but the engineers took it. So I need to have a new baby. And this is what it is. So I said, there's a long jump from superconducting. He said, but I use the same mathematics.
that's remarkable. You know, before I let you go, I want to plant a thought in you. This is my crazy idea, which has nothing to do with what we are talking about. I have, for at least 40 years, believed that in the context of the universe, in terms of its scale, I would regard not just our planetary system, but human beings as sort of quantum particles, that which makes it very difficult to predict our behavior. And that explains a lot of the strife and the problems that you see in the world. Because if you consider the size of what we are in, it's impossible to predict which way we might go. That's been my long-lasting theory.
I've written a very major article on this.
Oh, really? What
yes. You read that in my book, Nature of Human Thought. You know, we are all individuals darting around because of our whatever. But in the long run, we all come together. For example, I'll give you an since you're a man of physics. When we heat the water in a beaker, then the individual particles, when they get energy, they dart around. But after some time, the convection currents start. This convection currents are a part of the, you know, where you call chaos theory, etc. Everything.
Right.
They come to as an attractor. And all of us are like that. We are all darting, but ultimately in the whole bigger scenario, there is a convection current, which is basically the evolution of mankind. That is governed by the energy that the earth is getting, which is mostly solar energy.
Right.
And so that is what it is. So we are governed by that. So if you look at a thermodynamics, this is what is the ultimate.
That's fascinating. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think we'll probably run it in a day or two. I'll send you all the links.
Okay. Okay.
And it was a great pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure. It was pleasure, Mayank. Nice talking to you.
Likewise. And all the best. And hopefully when I come to India, I would be very happy to visit you.
Oh, that'll be wonderful. Then you can see how I'm a useless person sitting in a small rural area.
Asa bolu na ka.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I used to be pretty good at that. I started my career in Bombay.
Oh,
but
really?
Beech mein ab Hindi aa jati hai, Angrezi aa jati hai. But I understand Marathi fully. I have a dear friend called Shirish Kanekar, whose Marathi I kept listening to all the time. He speaks of a very high order. He's a great writer. So I understand Marathi, but unfortunately, I cannot speak it that well.
But now let me tell you the real story. Yeah. I'm from Lucknow, from UP.
Oh, really?
I don't know very much Marathi. I can understand. And my wife comes from the most distinguished Maharashtrian family.
Oh.
Maharishi Karve. She's a great-granddaughter of Maharishi
Karve. Oh, acha.
And the granddaughter of Iravati Karve.
Okay. No, so you have a lineage on that side. Yeah. No, great. Terrific. And all the best and good night to you. I'll be in touch soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.